Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over a decade, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. In only four cases since 1975, has the U.S. Congress passed all appropriation bills before the beginning of the fiscal year. In some years, like 1996, inaction led to agencies suspending operations. This year, Congress adopted a six-month continuing resolution for all fiscal year 2013 appropriation bills, delaying final decision until March 31st. What do these delays mean for how agencies manage their monies and operations? How do funding delays affect grantees and contractors? What does all this talk about the impending fiscal cliff really mean? And just what is a continuing resolution? And how can the federal budget process be improved? Today, we'll explore these questions and so much more with Professor Phil Joyce, a budget expert at the University of Maryland and author of the recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriations. This report examines the impact of late budgets over the past 37 years and identifies useful coping strategies while offering recommendations on how to soften the adverse effects of budget uncertainty. Welcome, Professor Joyce. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. Before we delve into your recent IBM Center report, The Cost of Budget Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impacts of Late Appropriations, I'd like to provide some context and explain certain realities that beset our period. First things first, would you elaborate on what is meant today by the coming fiscal cliff, and what are the conditions that precipitated this situation?
Well, it's a good question, and of course, it's a question that lots of people are asking right now in Washington. The fiscal cliff results from many factors, and the thing that they all have in common is that they're all self-inflicted. There are really two big components of the fiscal cliff. First, the Bush tax cuts that were passed in 2001 and then 2003 were sunset in order to make them more affordable. But what that means is that while they were kind of phased in a little at a time, they all go away at once. And when a tax cut goes away, it means people are experiencing a big tax increase. So people are right now slated to experience a big tax increase as of the beginning of January. The second is that when the so-called super committee in 2011 failed to reach agreement on a set of spending cuts and tax increases to cut $1.2 trillion from the budget deficit, there was a process put in place called sequestration, which is a set of automatic spending cuts that are also scheduled to take effect at the same time. So if you add those two things together plus a number of other sort of little things or smaller things, there's a total of about $5 trillion worth of tax increases and spending cuts over 10 years that's scheduled to go into effect. And that's what people describe as the fiscal cliff. Now, as I say, the fiscal cliff, if it is a cliff, and I sort of prefer to think of it as a slope more than a cliff because it's not like a government shutdown or even a debt ceiling failure where kind of really bad things happen all at once. It's more that over a long period of time, you're going to have, you know, less spending and you're going to have higher taxes. But the cliff is really – the existence of the cliff is a failure of our politics. That is, it's the failure of our ability to kind of come together and put together a budget that is really sort of consistent with what a budget ought to be, which is kind of trying to match up spending and revenues. And so we built it, you know, kind of – block by block or stone by stone. The problem is not really a disagreement, I think, about whether the deficit needs to be cut, which it does need to be cut. I think the basic problem is that if you just let the fiscal cliff kick in, then it's going to happen in a very sort of unreflected way. And so what people are looking for now is not trying to necessarily avoid having the deficit cut, but do it in a more sort of responsible and considered way. And that, of course, is the difficulty, because the reason we have this to begin with is because people haven't been able to agree on, one party says it doesn't want to raise taxes, another party says it doesn't want to touch entitlements. So the question is, given this looming deadline, really, the fiscal cliff deadline, are they going to be able to get together and do something now?
So, Professor Joyce, what has led to the current dysfunction of the federal budget process? And more importantly, has the apparent erosion of consensus among participants led to where we are today? And will just reforming the process bring back or resuscitate that consensus?
It's a very good question. I think that the answer to the first question really sort of logically flows into the answer to the second. It is such a political problem and so much not a procedural problem that I am one who's very skeptical about the ability of the process to do anything about it. But let's go back to why we have the dysfunction that we have. I think the short answer is that political leaders, and I use the term advisedly, care more about gaining partisan advantage than they do about governing, and they do about making sure that government operates well. I don't mean this as a partisan statement necessarily. It's just an example. But sometime, I don't know when it was, 2009, 2010, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate made the statement that the primary goal of the Republican Party was to make President Obama a one-term president. That is not a recipe for governing. It's not a recipe for achieving consensus. And so if both parties are trying to kind of look and see how they can gain political advantage over the other one, it doesn't encourage them to compromise. Now, part of what I think is kind of symptomatic of this is that we don't have many moderates left in either the House of Representatives or the Senate. There used to be not a majority, but at least a sort of critical mass of people who were in the middle. But they were very important because they helped things get done. And so you could get a coalition of moderates of both parties to align with some Republicans on one side or some Democrats on the other side in order to get things done. Increasingly, the parties are very polarized. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, including redistricting, which has led in part to this polarization because both parties have been trying to create a larger number of sort of safe districts for their members. So you have heavily Republican districts, heavily Democratic districts. But the fact is that you just haven't had a lot of people expressing moderate views. Now, there is some good news here, which is that if you've been following some of the discussions on these fiscal cliff debates, there are some people on both sides, and I think especially in the Senate as opposed to the House, who've begun to express more moderate views on issues such as taxes and entitlements. It's not a choice between raising taxes and cutting spending. It is raising taxes and cutting spending, and the question is just which taxes and what spending.
Exactly. Well, this dysfunction, which you've outlined, does have consequences, and it either leads to government shutdown or the increasing use of continuing resolutions or CRs. Could you tell us a little bit more about what a continuing resolution is, and give us a little bit about the history?
A continuing resolution is literally a short-term appropriation. It is an appropriation typically which covers a portion of a fiscal year. And the reason it's called a continuing resolution is because it is allowing agencies to continue to spend at the level that they already are spending. That's a kind of classic continuing resolution. So if you had an appropriation for fiscal year 2012 and you had a continuing resolution for fiscal year 2013, it would just say continue doing all the stuff in fiscal year 2013 that you were doing in fiscal year 2012, but you can't do anything new and you can't stop doing anything that you were already doing. So that's a kind of classic continuing resolution. Now, the history here is a little bit interesting because continuing resolutions have been around for a long time. I mean, there are continuing resolutions, I think, have been around for most of this century. But there was no particular consequence to failing to enact appropriation bills by the beginning of the fiscal year until 1980, when the Attorney General at that time, Benjamin Civiletti, who was President Carter's last Attorney General, issued an opinion. And that opinion essentially said federal agencies are not permitted to enter into obligations, that is to spend money, in absence of an appropriation. Believe it or not, prior to that, even if there had not been an appropriation passed by the beginning of the fiscal year, federal agencies would continue to spend money because essentially they were taking the position that Congress couldn't have meant that. Congress couldn't have meant to stop funding them. But the Attorney General said you can't make the assumption that Congress didn't mean that. The fact is that if there's not an appropriation, you don't have the legal authority to spend money. So after that point, after 1980, if agencies didn't have appropriations, it meant they had to cease operations. Now, of course, this then led to sort of obvious questions, which is, okay, what if you're in the middle of a war? Do you at midnight on September 30th just kind of put your guns away and, you know, and leave the battlefield because you don't have an appropriation? So this led to the whole concept of exceptions and the fact that there were essential services that needed to continue. And then the question sort of came down to, okay, well, what is essential and what is non-essential? Initially, there was a pretty broad definition of what was essential, but then there was a kind of separate opinion that said, you know, this idea of essentiality, if you will, you know, was not quite as elastic a concept as people might think. And so we had kind of much tighter rules in terms of what's essential and not essential. You know, the main issue, and really one of the main issues that I was trying to focus on in this report, is just to kind of shine light on the fact that it has become the norm rather than the rule to have continuing resolutions, and that the impacts of those continuing resolutions are relatively invisible. What you are trying to avoid is very visible. That is, a government shutdown, even if it doesn't encompass the whole government, it always led to things like, you know, a padlock on the gates at Yellowstone National Park, you know, people not being able to do things, people going to Social Security offices to file for new benefits and, you know, there was no one home. So all of those things were visible. But the effect of continuing resolutions is more sort of invisible. But the motivation for sort of talking about this is that this is not a world where government shutdowns are bad, but continuing resolutions are okay. It's a matter of kind of which bad you want to choose, you know, because the continuing resolutions have their own sort of costs.
Well, in diagnosing the problem, your report does a wonderful job providing historical context around things like the CR or shutdown.
Right.
And I'd like for you to touch on the government shutdown concept. And you acknowledge that the term shutdown is not entirely accurate. Would you elaborate on why this is the case? And I think you alluded to it earlier.
Well, that's right. The reason it's not accurate is because in the first place, when there is a shutdown, the whole government doesn't shut down, because there is this provision for some things being declared as essential. But it's actually even a little broader than that, which is that the Congress, when I was describing the appropriations process earlier, I said the Congress has an appropriations process. I didn't say that that appropriations process actually at this point consists of the Congress passing 12 different appropriations bills. So those 12 appropriations bills are organized at least broadly according to government functions, although in some cases it's kind of hard to make sense out of why certain agencies are in appropriations bills together. But the fact is that most of the years, even when we have had a government shutdown imminent or threatened or even one that has occurred, it hasn't encompassed the entire government because there have been some appropriation bills that have actually been passed and signed into law prior to the beginning of the fiscal year. The last government shutdown we had was late 1995, early 1996. But for example, the Agriculture Department never shut down during that entire period of time, not because everyone in the Agriculture Department is considered to be essential, but because the Agriculture Department had an appropriations bill. The legislative branch had an appropriations bill, but the Interior Department, for example, did not have an appropriations bill. And so you might have a situation where, you know, you have an employee of the Department of Agriculture, an employee of the Department of the Interior, both working in the same area of the country, but the Agriculture Department employee is at work. The Interior Department employee is not because the Agriculture Department employee is essential and the Interior Department employee is not, but because the Agriculture Department has an appropriations bill and the Interior Department does not. So it's much more complicated than to just say that either the government shuts down or the government does not shut down.
So, Professor Joyce, another term has entered our popular imagination, and that is sequestration. And I'd like to understand, what exactly is sequestration and what's the implication were it to go into effect January 2013?
The first is that there was something called the Budget Control Act, and the Budget Control Act was what was passed by the Congress as, in a sense, a cost of the Congress agreeing to this increase in the debt ceiling in August of 2011. And when the Budget Control Act was passed, it created this new Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, which most people refer to as the super committee, although in retrospect it wasn't so super. But what happened was that the law said if the super committee reaches agreement on at least $1.2 trillion in cuts over 10 years, then great. If it doesn't, then we're going to put this process in place for there to be automatic spending cuts in order to substitute for that $1.2 trillion. Now, the Congress, in its infinite wisdom, thought it had passed a law where the effect of the automatic spending cuts would be so abhorrent to so many people that it would force the super committee to actually reach agreement, because the worst possible thing would be to let this sequestration process kick in. But guess what? The worst possible thing happened, which is that it did allow the sequestration process to kick in. And without getting into mind-numbing detail about sequestration, I think the best thing to do is just to sort of point out that in general, sequestration covers a time period from fiscal year 2013 through fiscal year 2021. And in every year, there are an equal amount of cuts totaling about $55 billion each, or $110 billion total per year, equally divided between defense and non-defense. So defense is going to be cut every year by $55 billion if the sequestration goes into effect, and non-defense programs are going to be cut by an equivalent $55 billion. Now, the $55 million for non-defense is divided between some cuts in so-called mandatory programs, which are entitlements like Medicare, and some cuts in domestic discretionary spending. So the domestic discretionary cuts, that is the appropriated cuts, are a little bit less than the defense cuts, but it is equal between defense and non-defense. Now, the notion was that Republicans would never put up with a defense cut this big, and that Democrats would never put up with Medicare and other domestic programs being cut. So the question at this point is, because it still hasn't taken effect, will it be allowed to take effect? President Obama, in his budget proposal last year, said, I don't want this to take effect, but he recommended a substitute set of cuts that would substitute, would add up to the same amount of money, but would substitute for the sequestration cuts. The Congress didn't go along with that, but they really have sort of three options at this point. The first option is to let it take effect. The second option is to come up with an equivalent amount of cuts, but have substitute cuts. The third option would be to reduce the amount of that would be covered under sequestration, or somehow change the law, you know, from where it was. Because, you know, I hate to put this flippantly, but it's only a law, and you know, and laws can be changed.
How does budgetary uncertainty impact federal agencies? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.